Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, David Liss. Welcome to episode 90 of The World Shapers. Yep, I've done 90 of them, counting this one. And not only that, I have completed the third year of this podcast. That's quite amazing to me. I remember when I started and I had no idea how long it would go, yet here we are 3 years in. This is the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. I am myself an author of science fiction fantasy. Again, my name is Edward Willett. Let's see, what's my latest thing? Well, I have a young adult novel out called Star Song, just came out last month. Very near and dear to me because it's a novel that grew out of one of my earliest sold short stories, The Minstrel, which is in my short story collection, Paths to the Stars. And I tried to get a novel version of it written in way back in the early part of my career. And it was almost published by a major publisher in the early 90s. But things didn't work out. The publisher died. They decided not to publish science fiction anymore. So I never got it published until now. And of course, after some 30 years of additional writing, I think I brought some additional skills to the story. So I rewrote it, and it's now out from shadowpawpress.com and available everywhere. Star Song, it's called. And it's a far future outer space adventure, very much in the mode of Robert A. Heinlein and Andre Norton, who are huge influences on me as a young reader. So check that out, Star Song. You can find it on any bookstore, online bookstore. You can find it also at shadowpawpress.com. Then, of course, the other thing coming up is the second anthology that I've kickstarted featuring authors who have been on this podcast. I mentioned that we just finished the third year. Well, the current anthology is Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, which features authors who were guests during the second year of this podcast. All the stories are in. The editing is almost done, so it's looking good for a fall release. And there'll be new fiction from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Helly Kennedy, Lisa Kester, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Zoll, and me. And stories by Jeffrey A. Carver, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S.M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. It's looking like it's going to be very close to 150,000 words of fiction, a very substantial collection. So I'm very excited to bring that out in the next couple of months. I'm thinking October sometime. I don't have a precise date yet. But again, you can read more about that at shadowpawpress.com. And when it comes out, it will be available Amazon or any other online bookstore that you might like to name in both ebook and print formats. All right, well, that's kind of the introductory stuff about me and upcoming projects. So it's time to get on to this episode's guest. First, I want to remind you that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. And now, this episode's guest, David Liss. David Liss is the author of 14 novels, as well as numerous novellas and short stories. His previous books include A Conspiracy of Paper, which was named a New York Times Notable Book and won the 2001 Barry McCavity and Edgar Awards for Best First Novel. The Coffee Trader was also named a New York Times Notable Book and was selected by the New York Public Library as one of the year's 25 books to remember. Many of his novels are currently being developed for television or film. David has worked on numerous comics projects as well, including Black Panther and Mystery Men for Marvel, The Spider and Green Hornet for Dynamite, and Angelica Tomorrow. So, David, welcome to the World Shapers.
Well, thank you. It's good to be talking to you.
I was just saying before we started that I've talked to a number of... we're going to be talking primarily about your upcoming book, The Peculiarities, with Tachyon, and they've recommended a number of their authors to me, and I always get good conversation. So I'm very happy to chat with Tachyon's stable of authors.
They have a great list. I was really quite happy to be numbered among them.
And they do good covers too. I really like the cover of the book that's coming up as well.
Well, yeah, I love it as well. But thank you.
I have nothing to do with my covers either. But still,
exactly. It's always nice when you get a good one because you really can't do anything about a bad one.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we'll start with the traditional start of a World Shapers interview, which is to take you back into the mists of time. I don't know how far back that is for you. It's getting pretty far back for me, and to find out how you. Well, first of all, where you grew up and all that sort of thing, but how you then got interested in, it usually starts with reading, and then writing. How did that all come about for you?
Well, I grew up in South Florida, a place I got away from as soon as I possibly could. And I've always been really just like a kind of what I would say is a narrative junkie. I've loved narrative. I've loved story in pretty much any form, be it prose fiction, comics, film, television, what have you. And I don't feel like I was an early reader. I don't have memories of being a voracious reader until I was in middle school. But I remember a kind of formative experience, which was I had a much older stepbrother, and I walked into a room where he was watching TV one day, and he had Star Trek on, and I'd never seen Star Trek before, and it was the episode in which Captain Kirk fights a giant lizard man called a Gorn, and I basically said, I don't know what this is, but I want, you know, a ton of this in my life.
Sounds familiar.
And that really was the moment for me where I became convinced that what I wanted was to ingest story and also to produce story.
Were you a eclectic devourer of stories? You weren't just reading one particular kind of story?
So I think the first thing I really got hooked on as a reader was actually horror. And I still like horror a lot. I read horror. I've written a lot of horror short fiction. My new novel, The Peculiarities, has certain horror elements, even though I wouldn't classify it as horror. But, you know, sometimes you become really interested in something and then you realize that what you love is actually similar, but not exactly that. I remember in high school, I had a lot of friends who really liked heavy metal music. And I thought, oh, I love this. This is for me. And then one day I discovered punk. And I was like, no, wait, this is actually what I like. And they're similar, but they're not quite the same. And I would say after 2 or 3 years as a voracious horror reader, I then stumbled into science fiction and fantasy. And those became my mainstays of reading enjoyment.
Were there any specific books that you remember that were particularly influential?
When I was younger, I think the first thing I remember reading that really captured my imagination in that way was, and for a lot of readers, or a lot of writers, rather, of my generation, they mentioned this book, which is A Wrinkle in Time.
Uh-huh.
And
I think we're of the same generations.
That's my sense as well. And, you know, there was just something about that book's ability to stretch the imagination and produce not just a sense of wonder, but also a kind of intellectual curiosity that I think makes it a real touchstone. From there, I moved on to Tolkien. I'm not a fan of The Hobbit. I've been booed at conventions for saying as much. I distinctly remember reading it and thinking, maybe when I'm an adult, this opening will make more sense to me. And I can tell you, as an adult, it still makes no sense to me. But I loved Lord of the Rings, and from there I went on to pretty much read any fantasy that I could.
But when did you start trying to write it yourself along in there?
When did I start trying to write? I actually have memories of writing long before I was a voracious reader. I have a memory of trying to write a Star Trek-like short story when I was in the second grade. And I dabbled in and out with writing fiction for most of my childhood. I was never particularly dedicated to it. I recognized that I wasn't especially good. And I think my sense was that I wanted to wait until I got good, as though that were something that would happen to me externally or without my control, like growing. Getting good at writing was like getting taller.
I wish. Really,
yeah, no, exactly. I've heard other writers on your podcast talking about writing novels when they were in high school, and that definitely was not me. I just felt unequal to the task, and it wasn't until I was an adult that I really became serious about learning how to do this thing that I really wanted to do.
But you didn't study writing to begin with. I from reading on your website, you were pursuing something entirely different.
Yes, I took some creative writing classes when I was in college, but I never studied writing formally. I did not go to an MFA program. I actually I reached this decision in my 20s where I said, well, clearly I'm never going to become a novelist because I haven't yet done that. But I loved books and I wanted to be around books. So I ended up going to graduate school to get a doctorate in English literature with the idea of becoming a literature professor. And I studied 18th century British literature. And then at a certain point when I was in grad school, I realized I didn't want to do this. Just to give you an example, my wife, who I met in grad school and who was, you know, at the same in the same year as I was preparing to go on the job market, and she would generally be one of 800 people applying for a job. And I was lying in bed awake at night, unable to sleep, worrying that I would get a job. And that's how I knew that maybe it wasn't what I really wanted to do. And at that point, I said, well, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer. And I decided to take a lot of the critical thinking skills that I developed in grad school and apply them toward figuring out what's a good novel? How does a novel work? How does a novel structurally function? And I really dedicated myself to that. I read a bunch of contemporary novels and I kind of took them apart and thought about why I liked a character or didn't, or why I was engaged or why I was bored in particular scenes, and really approached it from an element of craft, which is still how I think about writing. I think writing can and ideally should be art, but it has to be craft first, that books work or don't work for structural reasons. And that's always how I've thought about learning how to be better as a writer. And when I've taught creative writing, that's always what I focus on teaching my students.
So although you did not complete your doctorate, the process of working toward it and all the time you had spent thinking about literature and the critical thinking skills, it sounds like that definitely plays into your writing.
Absolutely. I went to a very, very rigorous and extremely unfriendly graduate program, and I really had to get smarter than I was in order to survive there. Those kinds of critical thinking skills and analytical thinking skills really serve me incredibly well every day. I'm a big champion of a humanities education for everyone because, you know, there's never a downside to being a good thinker.
So your first novel, tell me a little bit about that, A Conspiracy of Paper.
So that was based on my incomplete dissertation project, which was, as I mentioned, I did 18th century British literature, and I was very interested in how the novel, which really emerges as a genre around the latter end of the first half of the 18th century, how that connects to emerging ideas about money and finance and the individual and money. And if you look at early novels, there are financial concerns and are completely interwoven into them. And in you know, we might even think about it as a natural function of the novel, because throughout the 18th and 19th and 20th and on to today, we see it so much in novels. But it didn't have to be. You know, it's not a necessary element in fiction. And so I ended up taking a lot of the things I was interested about in this project and creating a novel, which was eventually called A Conspiracy of Paper, which was about the events leading up to the South Sea Bubble, which was the first stock market mm-hmm. crash in England. And I kind of turned it into a genre mystery, but it's very much about how... The idea of speculation, both in terms of financial speculation and detective speculation, emerge at the exact same moment.
And it seems to have been quite a successful first novel.
I was very happy with how it did. Yes, I had a wonderful, was able to land a really wonderful agent and then a wonderful editor, and my publisher really supported the book, and it was a great experience. It was a different time. So I ended up going on like lengthy book tours, and, you know, I went from being a penniless graduate student to staying in nice hotels and being able to eat the Pringles from the minibar and not have to pay for it. It was a dream come true.
That's still my dream, is to not have to pay for what's in the minibar. It hasn't happened to me yet, but
it's pretty good.
So you're starting basically with historical fiction, and yet you had gravitated towards these science fiction and fantasy when you were, reading in high school and so forth. When did the speculative elements make it into your fiction? How much of that have you done?
First, I would say I've always felt as a reader that historical fiction and fantasy are much more closely related than people often recognize or consider, especially if you're talking about historical fiction from before physically recorded history, by which I mean photographs and recordings and film, because there's a lot of world building involved. We really mm-hmm. don't know directly what life was like for people before we could record human activity. We can guess based on writing, but that's always a kind of a distant representation. People tend to write idealized versions of what they imagine life to be rather than record what's actually happening or how they actually thought. That element of writing historical fiction really, in many ways, scratched the itch of my genre reading interests. But once I was locked into that path, I didn't really feel like I could branch out. I actually, after I sold my first book, I immediately started work on a science fiction novel that I never finished. And my editor, my agent, really discouraged me from working on it. And so I wrote several historical novels. I wrote a either contemporary or historical crime thriller, depending on what year you were born, because it was published in the early 2000s, but set in the 1980s. So the mileage may vary on whether or not that's historical fiction. And I was pretty much, you know, moving steadily on that track until I got contacted by an editor at Marvel who asked me if I wanted to write for comics for Marvel. And I was thrilled. I was a lifelong comics reader. And writing for Marvel and doing those comics really made me feel like I love genre fiction. I certainly love writing historical fiction as well, but I wanted to do other things that I loved. And I ended up writing a historical fantasy called The Twelfth Enchantment, which was in many ways a rethinking of Jane Austen with Regency era elements of magic linked to the revived interest in magic from the Romantic period. And I few years after that, I wrote a trilogy of middle grade space opera novels, the Random series, and now with The Peculiarities, that's my second historical fantasy.
It's interesting what you said about historical fiction sort of scratching that world-building itch to a certain extent. I often make the point when I'm talking to people about writing, especially if I'm talking to people who have that sense in their head, you know, that there's mainstream fiction, which is real, and then fantasy fiction, which is all made up. And I always like to make out the point that whatever you, and you sort of touched on this, whatever you read in a book is not the real world. A mainstream novel is every bit as much a made-up world. It mimics the real world, but it's not the real world. It's a world that's built out of nothing, just like every other fictional world. And historical fiction, of course, you're working from hints and clues and what materials there are, but ultimately you're still constructing a world that's not what the real world was. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think that's 100% accurate. I really agree with that entirely. And just to go back to a point I was talking about earlier. So in the 18th century, we can look at how conversations are related in novels. We can look at how conversations are related in journalistic pieces or in court transcripts, but we really have no idea what an actual conversation between two people on the street might have sounded like. And just as you wouldn't know what a 21st century conversation between two people might sound like based on what you read in a novel or see in a film. It's a very stylized, cleaned up, focused version of what people talk like, but it's not realistic.
I wanted to, and switching over now to the comics, that's a very different kind of writing than writing novels. It's more like writing a script, isn't it? Like a play script.
In fact, when the editor at Marvel first contacted me, he wanted me to do one particular project, which was for, I think, Marvel's 70th anniversary, where they were getting people who had not previously written comics to take on some characters from Marvel's earliest days. And I said, I don't really want to learn how to write in a completely different medium and then never do it again. So I kind of extracted a guarantee from him that they would tap me for more things, because it was a real learning curve. Novels are obviously inherently literary, and comics are visual in their storytelling. And the words on the page, the dialogue or the captions, really represent only a small fraction of the storytelling that's happening. And I really had to learn to think about story in a very different way.
They're kind of a cross between an actual, like a play script or a movie script, and a novel in a way. It feels to me, because comics, you can get a certain amount of internal monologue thoughts, whereas in a play, unless they do a monologue directly to the audience, I guess, so there is that, or they break the fourth wall. But especially in movies, everything is on the surface. It's, you know, you can't get inside the head the way you can in a novel. And I guess in comics, you can do that a little bit, but it's still primarily going to be the dialogue and the pictures that carry the story.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you also have the limitation of the visual story being told in panels. Hmm. So you have this collection of static images that have to be dynamic and fluid at the same time. So you have a little more flexibility in some ways than in a film or television script, and less flexibility in other ways. So it's its own thing. It's definitely its own storytelling medium, and has things that it does very well and things that are difficult to do.
And the script comes first, I presume, and the art comes afterwards. So do you have to think in terms of, you know, short bits of text? You can't go on too long. You can't be long-winded, because it simply won't work in a panel.
Yes, and I also learned when working on my first series for Marvel that it will also really annoy the artist and the letterer if you have too much text. and especially comics today, if you look back at, you know, especially the kind of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby comics from the 60s, there was text all over the page. Comics are have much less text now than they did in the mid 20th century. So you have to learn how to really limit your word usage. You also have to, when you start working with a particular artist on a regular basis, you also start to think about, what is this artist good at? What does this artist do really well that I can take advantage of and use to really further the story or the sense of character or whatever it is that I want to punch in a particular scene? So there's definitely a very different set of tools to play with.
I've only ever done anything like it once for an exhibit at the Saskatchewan Science Center where I used to work. And there we had an artist and we had this little comic story and I wrote the script for it. And even in that little bit, I thought, well, this is different from what I'm used to. So if any big comic people are out there and they're looking for a writer, I am available. I just thought I'd mention that. So let's go on to your creative process, and we're going to talk about the peculiarities. So maybe before we start on the process side, tell me a little bit about the peculiarities, whatever you want to say as to what it's about without giving away something you don't want to give away.
Okay. So the novel is set at the very end of the 19th century, and it is set in this moment where in actuality there was a, I mentioned in a previous book, The Twelfth Enchantment, there was a revival of interest in the supernatural in the early 19th century, and there was another revival at the end of the 19th century. And it's about that moment. There was a lot of interest in spiritualism, and then in what we would call ceremonial magic. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and people like Aleister Crowley, and this was their moment. And it's a period I've always been interested in. And so for this novel, what I wanted to do was I wanted to write about the Golden Dawn and this interest in ceremonial magic and take it seriously. I've always been fascinated with magic as it was practiced by real people who believed that what they were doing was working. And so I wanted to take this kind of magic seriously and have it be extremely effectual. And rather than write a novel that was a secret history about how magic has always worked, but nobody knew it, or it was only a select number of people knew it, it's set in this world where in the last quarter of the 19th century, magic suddenly starts to become effective in a way that it wasn't before. And we start seeing some really profound changes taking place, especially in certain urban areas. And this story is set in London, which is one of these areas where you're starting to see people metamorphose into strange shapes. There are kind of otherworldly creatures who are wandering the streets, and people are practicing magic and taking advantage of these changes. And my main character is this guy named Thomas, and just very briefly, I don't want to give too much story away, but he's from a banking family, and his family has always regarded him as a kind of unnecessary appendage. His father barely acknowledged him. He has a much older brother who treats him dismissively. And shortly before the novel begins, the father dies. And even though he's always been excluded from the family business, one of the stipulations of the will is that Thomas has to begin working as an apprentice clerk in the bank. And while he's there, he stumbles upon a kind of financial mystery. I've written about financial history before, and something I find interesting. And this financial mystery leads him into the world of ceremonial magic and the Golden Dawn, which is of much interest to him because he's also undergoing a bit of a bizarre transformation himself. He's growing leaves all over his body, and he recognizes that he's eventually going to turn into a tree.
Well, and that probably is a good place to mention that it is actually comedic, is it not?
I don't think of it as a comedic novel, but I like to be funny when I write. I think humor is a part of life that, you know, people crack jokes at very serious moments. People tell jokes at funerals, and the narrative has what I think is a period-appropriate dry sense of humor, and certain characters in the novel are inclined to be funny, but it's also, I think, a pretty, in some ways, a very serious and slightly dark story. So, you know, there are some unpleasant things that happen.
Well, you're just reading the description of it, calls it an absurdist comedic romp. So somebody thinks it's comedic.
I'll take it.
All right. So let's using this as an example. It's a cliche, I know, but where do you get your ideas? And you kind of touched on this, actually, where this one came from. But in general, where do things bubble up that you decide you're going to write a novel about?
I think all of my novels have begun in one of two ways. Either it begins as a scene that just pops into my head, an interaction under particular circumstances between particular types of characters that really intrigues me. And I'll just build something out from that. Often that scene will not remain an opening scene in a novel, or in certain cases has not even made it into the final version of the novel. But it'll just be this fully realized character moment that pops into my head that I just find very irresistible and want to build out from and play with. Or they can begin as kind of a more intellectual exercise. I want to write about X. I wrote a novel a few years ago called The Day of Atonement, and that began with me saying, I want to write about the Lisbon earthquake of 1755. And I did a whole bunch of research until I found a narrative that I loved and wanted to write about. And so the peculiarities also began with me wanting to write about specific things. I wanted to write about banking, and I wanted to write about Golden Dawn magic, and I wanted to try and incorporate a story from the early 18th century, which always lodged into my brain and was one of those things that I knew I wanted to write about someday, which was a story of this woman named Mary Tofts, who convinced much of England's medical establishment that she was giving birth to rabbits. And medical science was such in the early 18th century that it seemed an entirely plausible thing that could happen. So I wanted to write a novel that included women giving birth to rabbits, which does indeed happen in this novel.
It sounds like there would have been a considerable amount of research involved in this one. When do you do the research? After you've planned out the novel, or before, or does it all happen at once, or how does that work for you?
For me, research is a multi-stage process. I have a particular method I follow. William James says that people can only learn things they already know, which I actually kind of believe. So I tend to start very low level. I'll read, if it's a period I don't know well at all, I'll read popular histories, watch documentaries on television, and get a comfortable background, and then move toward more focused scholarly work, monographs, and then actual primary source material. And if it's a location I don't know, then eventually I will go visit it. But that usually waits until I have a solid draft of the novel and know what it is that I actually need to look at in the place I'm going to.
Did you need to go to London for this one, or did you know London well?
I know London well. My father's English, and I have a lot of family in London, and I've been there many times. So I did not need to go for this book, but I have been on research trips to London in the past.
What does your planning outlining look like then? Do you do a detailed outline, or do you just kind of wing it?
I definitely do not wing it. I write a moderately detailed outline that tends to focus more on major plot and character moments. I want to know what the significant points of the various characters' journeys are through the story, and I definitely need to know where they're going to end up. So I tend to do bullet point outlines. I'll write much longer, kind of thinking out loud pieces that I'll then distill into bullet points. A lot of my early work in planning a novel it's like a conversation with myself that I write out. It's very much me writing things like, well, I know I want this character to end up in financial trouble, but I don't know how. What are some things I can do? And then I'll make a list, and then I'll comment to myself about what I like or dislike about the things on the list. And that sort of internal dialogue on the page is really kind of how I shake things loose. And then I'll start writing, and very frequently the outline will change. I'm a big believer that you do a different kind of creating when you're thinking about writing than when you're actually writing, that the writing process, at least for me, unlocks a different kind of creativity, and I see things and make connections or have ideas that I simply would never have in the outline phase. And if it's a good idea, I'll run with it, and then I'll change my outline accordingly.
Yeah, that's the way it is for me too. We talk about outlines, and sometimes they're actually done in point form. So I kind of think of it, it's kind of pointillistic. So it gives a version of the story that you can sort of make up the broad outlines, but then the actual writing is analog, so it's like following the groove of a long playing record, and it just flows one thing into the next, which is quite different from when you're thinking about it more in terms of discrete scenes and things like that, at least for me.
I think for me as well, there's just a kind of excitement and energy ability to make connections when you're writing, or when I'm writing in any case, that I just can't access when I'm outlining. And I don't know why. It would really be convenient if I could summon the same kind of creativity while outlining. I know a lot of writers like to mystify the process, and they talk about how their characters speak to them and just wanted to do something different, and they went their own way. And I actually really resist that kind of mystifying of the process. My characters do not speak to me. If they did, I'd be worried about my sanity. But I just see opportunities to do exciting, interesting things that are going to be fun to write and hopefully fun to read when the words are being put on the page.
Yeah, I'm never confused that my characters are the ones doing the story, but it's because you're inhabiting the characters as you write it that you start to look out through their eyes and see what they would see, and then you think, oh, I can take the character there. And speaking of characters, how do you discover the characters that you need in the story? How do you decide what characters you need?
Often I'll decide in a very clinical way. Like, I need a character who is capable of doing these sorts of things, or undergoes this kind of emotional transformation, or puts up this sort of roadblock for another character. And they tend to, they often, in outline form, might come across as very wooden, and I really only discover their three-dimensionality or what makes them really interesting when the writing begins. And especially, as you mentioned, when you get inside their heads and start to see what really would make this a believable, interesting, complicated, unusual character. And for that reason, my characters do often, not of their volition, but of mine, go in different directions than I anticipated. So, for example, in The Peculiarities, Aleister Crowley is one of the principal secondary characters. And as some of your readers may know, he was a kind of a notorious and hedonistic practicing magician in the late 19th through the mid 20th centuries, and had a reputation as a real scoundrel. And in the novel, he I planned him to be exactly that, just as a kind of villain who my main character has to make use of. And I just had so much fun writing him. He ended up transforming into one of those people who, we all know somebody like this who's, you might say, well, he's a jerk or she's a jerk, but they're my jerk. and he ends up being a kind of much more likable character than I intended, because that's really where the energy of the story wanted to go.
Do you do anything with your characters, like a detailed biography of each one and description and all that? Or does that also kind of evolve as you write them?
That definitely evolves as I write. I usually just have, a very basic understanding of what kind of character it is and what their narrative function is. And then they become fleshed out and more realistic and develop physical appearances as I write the story. I tend to think of characters on an emotional level. So when I'm thinking about, oh, this is a character that I'm really excited to write, and they're going to undergo this kind of transformation, and they're going to have this kind of relationship, I will have no idea what this person looks like. And then as I'm writing the story, I think, well, I guess this person needs to be described, because that's what we writers do. But that's not what makes a character real for me as I'm writing or when I'm reading. To me, it's like their emotional lives are what I find fascinating, not their physical appearance.
Yeah, I hate describing physical appearance, because invariably I forget what I described, and then I have to go back and make sure I haven't changed their eye color or their skin color even, or their hair color or whatever.
I'm the same way. I just, because it's not something that really excites my creative imagination, it's secondary. So in my notes, one of the things I've learned to do over the years is base my character's physical appearance on either people I know or on actors or celebrities, and I'll put a picture of whoever is the source of the physical appearance in my file, so I can go back and say, oh, right, you know, that's the hair color.
Well, that sounds like a good idea, and I have thought of doing it for about 40 years now, but I haven't started yet, so that's, you know, I'm in my 60s, time to turn over to new leaf and be more organized, I guess. So what is your actual writing process look like? Are you, I always ask, and I find very few people that write longhand, so you probably aren't one of them, but if you are, that would be interesting.
I'm definitely not one of them. I write on a computer. My writing schedule and routine has changed over the years. About 10 years ago, I was a cafe writer, which I believe I've heard you say you are as well.
Yeah, I do like to write out of the house somewhere.
And then, you know, I was very, very productive. I wrote, you know, several novels in the same spot of a coffee shop where they I had my special table they reserved for me every day, and I was very well treated. It was a great experience. But one day I realized I don't want to be here anymore. I want to be at home with my cats. And so I started writing at home. And then I've always been an early riser. I used to wake up early and go exercise first thing in the morning. And I've shifted to starting my writing day early. So I normally start my writing day at about 4 in the morning when I wake up. Mm. And it's during the school year, and I have to deal with taking children to school. I'll usually write between 4 and 8, and then do child transport, and then get back to it. And I'm done with most of my writing work for the day by noon.
Well, that's a new leaf I'm not turning over, writing at 4 in the morning.
if it's not something you want to do, I don't recommend it. But I also, you know, I believe people should live by their own biorhythms.
And one of the interesting things about this podcast is how different everybody is in the way that they approach, they approach the way they work and how they work, which is why I always ask the question. And for people who want to be a writer, it's like there is no one way to do this.
Absolutely. And so my process throughout the arc of the novel, I also think is a little weird. And I don't know a lot of people who work this way, maybe nobody. And for my first few books, I always felt like this is a stupid way to write. I need to write like a normal person. And then eventually I figured, well, I've written 4 books this way. It must be working. And that is after I do my outline, I hammer out a rough draft as quickly as I possibly can. It is a almost like a proof of concept exercise. It's somewhere between the ugliest imaginable rough draft and a fleshed out outline. And I'll often write a 250-page draft in about a month. And then I'll spend you know, the better part of a year revising, just going over and over and over and cutting things out and adding things and reworking things and playing with what's there. I actually don't love the process of writing, but I love revising. Mm. And so I want to get to the revision stage as quickly as possible.
I enjoy revision. That always seems to be when the book comes more alive than it did in the original writing sometimes. And often when I'm writing, and like the thing I'm writing now, I've been struggling with a bit, my next book for my publisher. But I will be writing it and just say, okay, as long as I get it down, I get to the end, then I can go back and fix this thing I already know needs fixing, but I'm not going to stop and fix it now. I'm going to revise it, and then it will be good. So it's...
Yeah, it sounds like we have very similar processes. For me, the blank page is, you know, just this, you know, vacuum in space waiting to suck me into oblivion. But if I have words on the page, then I have something to work with.
Well, and I've mentioned, and this came up in the very first podcast episode with Robert J. Sawyer, there's a Canadian horror writer named Ido Van Belkom who apparently calls it this, and Rob Sawyer uses it too. His first draft he calls the vomit draft, because you get it out there on the page, and then you have to spend a lot of time cleaning up and making it pretty, but at least you got it out there on the page. And I always think of that.
Yeah, no, that's very apt.
Now, what does your revision process look like? You do a lot of revision. So what are the things that you are fixing, and as you go over and over it again, are there common things that you find in every book you have to really think about and fix up in the revision process?
Yeah, I you know, I still struggle in some ways with a lot of the bad habits that I had with my first novel, just because it's always my intuition to do things a particular way. I tend to really tell story through dialogue interaction, and I often have way too much characters talking back and forth and not enough you know, physical things happening in my book. So that's something I always look for. Again, the sort of physical world is not the first thing that occurs to me when I'm telling stories. So I always think, do readers need to know what this person or what this room or what these clothes look like? So I need to watch out for that kind of thing. And then mostly I'm just looking for flow, what works, what doesn't work, what maybe is going on too long, what, you know, just, you know, prose style, what maybe doesn't sound as good as it should. And I tend to do this in full draft. So I'll do a complete pass through a manuscript several times during this revision process.
Any idea how many times roughly?
It depends from book to book, but it can be dozens. Mm-hmm.
Then do you show it to someone else? Do you use beta readers or anything like that before it goes to your editor?
Yes, I actually have several friends who mostly they're other writers, but not all of them, who have been kind enough to me over the years to read works in progress. And, you know, different readers have, because I do different kinds of writing, I have different readers for different genres that I write and different styles. And they're incredibly important to me because, as I'm sure you know, when you've spent a lot of time looking at a manuscript, you often lose track of just what's there. You don't see what's on the page anymore. A lot of the emotion or energy or the, you know, just the force of the narrative you might imagine is there when it isn't. And so those beta readers are really vital to me for letting me know what I've done right and what I haven't done right yet.
Yeah, I've actually never had them to speak of, and it's just a function of where I grew up and not having anybody to draw on. I'm sure I could find them now, and there's something else, another leaf to turn over in my 60s. Start using more beta readers. I can see how they help, but it's just nothing I've ever gotten in the habit of doing. So it's always interesting to me.
As I'm sure you know, if it works, then you're doing it right.
I get published, so I guess something's not too bad. And then what happens at the editorial level? I mean, you've obviously, I'm sure you've worked with a number of different editors over the years. Has generally your experience with editors been positive?
Yeah, I've been very lucky over my career. I've worked, as you say, with a bunch of different editors, and they've almost all been editing editors, which are increasingly rare in the business. And I know a lot of aspiring writers imagine that editing is a terrible thing, and I've been asked by readers at events, like, you know, how, do you hate being edited? Do you hate when an editor tells you to change something? And the answer is no, I love it. You know, there's nothing better than a smart reader going through your book and telling you what can be better. And so I like an editor with a heavy hand, one who will point to what's not working, but not necessarily, I hope, tell me how to fix it, because that might be a heavier hand than I particularly want. But, you know, because I still want the book to be mine at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's I've done a lot of stage acting, and in theatrical terms, if you think, a good director is one who talks to you about what perhaps is and isn't working, but doesn't give you a line reading and doesn't tell you exactly how they want the line said. Usually actors really hate to be told exactly how to say a line. They want to figure it out for themselves. And I think that's kind of like editing too, where you want to have the editor, you know, can, and especially if they're a long established editor, they've seen way more books by way more authors struggling with way more story problems than you have. And they have some insight into how to deal with things, and they can lead you to a solution without rewriting your prose.
Yeah. And, you know, I really believe that editing is a real skill, and not all writers, not all great writers are necessarily great editors, and great editors are not necessarily particularly great writers. But somebody who has the ability to really dive into a piece of writing and doctor it, I mean, that's a wonderful thing.
I think we'll move on to my big philosophical questions, which, again, I keep meaning to put reverb on that. Big philosophical questions. And there are three of them. The first one is, why do you write? I mean, you've talked a little bit about it, but deep down, what is it that drives you to tell stories? On the larger level, why do you think any of us write? Why do human beings, why are we driven as human beings to do this strange thing of making up stories? And then the third question is, what is the third question? Oh, why stories with the fantastical element, magic or whatever, specifically? So there you go, my three big philosophical questions.
All of which are probably unanswerable, but I will take a shot. In terms of why people love stories, you know, this is something I've wondered about a lot. I mean, we know that that human beings started making... human beings were around for, you know, several tens of thousands of years before they started making art. And, you know, we know that, I guess, about 70,000 years ago, the first cave paintings start to appear, and they start to appear everywhere. And there's just something about human consciousness that is... That really thrives off narrative. And it could be a survival thing, like the ability to speculate about... I don't know where, if, you know, any animal can say, well, you know, I've learned that there are predators in this region, but, you need a certain amount of creativity to say there are predators in this region because there's this kind of prey in this region. And if the prey moves on, the predators will follow. So you could say that it's a survival instinct. But I don't know. I mean, there clearly is something hardwired in our consciousness that makes us love stories. I speculate it's a byproduct of something that helped us survive. It's probably not the thing itself, but for whatever reason, I really do believe that it's something all people are born with, is a love of narrative. For me, why I feel the need to produce it as well as consume it, I guess I don't really know the answer to that either, but I've always, it's just something that I've always felt driven to do. For me, there's a real, there's a real joy in telling stories and creating characters and putting them in situations that are emotionally resonant. It's just something that, as for as long as I can remember, I've wanted to do, in the same way that there are people who are really driven to make music or to, you know, build things or to be athletes or whatever else. I think we all have a set of things that we're inclined to do that hopefully we're good at or can learn to become good at. And for whatever reason, this is mine. And the third thing was, why speculative fiction? And, you know, it's just one of those things that I've always loved. I've written other kinds of genre fiction, and I've written non-genre fiction. And all of these different kinds of storytellings really get at something different that I love about narrative. For me, science fiction and fantasy is just really transporting, I guess, also in the way that historical fiction is. But I love the idea of visiting different kinds of places that we can't really go to, and seeing kinds of things, and especially experiencing different cultures that are otherwise unavailable to us, and imagining what it would be to live under really alien and foreign and in many ways unknowable circumstances.
Is part of the joy for you in writing the response from readers? I mean, writing is a form of communication, or would you do it even if nobody was reading it? You've had some success, so you do have lots of readers.
Yeah, I don't know that I would do it if nobody was reading it. I think if, you know, I received some kind of if I was sued by the government and told I could no longer publish again, under some bizarre and probably science fictional circumstances, I don't know if I would continue. I definitely do think having readers is part of it for me. I think.
Do you get a lot of feedback from readers?
I do, and it's always really interesting, you know. As I've said, I've written different kinds of books, and you know, I still my favorite kind of feedback is still getting letters from younger readers who read my middle grade novels. There's something incredibly delightful about that, and I love hearing from readers, and I love hearing what they got out of books. But I don't know that I need to hear from readers so much as I just need to know they're out there.
Well, and The Peculiarities comes out September 21st, is it?
I think it's the 7th. But,
oh, the 7th, okay. September 20th, I'm remembering 2021. That's where the 21 crept in there. So not too long. What are you working on? Oh, yeah, that's right there on your website, September 7th, 2021. There we go. Which will be not too long after this goes live. And what are you working on now?
I'm now actually working on my first crack at writing epic fantasy, although it's of a fairly historical bent. It's based in a world that's modeled off of the ancient Near East, which is a period I've always found fascinating. And in many ways, it's an attempt to grapple with the religions of the time and place and treat them seriously. Kind of a pre-Homeric idea of what gods are and what role they play in human lives.
How far along is that project?
It is pretty far along. You know, it's in my agent's hands at the moment.
And where can readers find you online?
They can find me online at my website, which is davidlist.com. I'm also on Twitter at David_Liss, and theoretically on Facebook, although I have not logged on to Facebook in several years.
Very theoretical.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much, David, for being on The World Shapers. I enjoyed the chat. I hope you did too.
Yes, so did I. It was great talking to you. Thank you.
And bye for now.
Goodbye.
So thanks once again to David Liss for that great conversation. I certainly enjoyed it, and I hope you did as well. And I hope that you will continue to come back in the future as we enter the fourth year of the World Shapers podcast. Among others, I have Laurel K. Hamilton coming up, to name just one name that just popped into my head. So there's a lot of great authors and interviews yet to come. You can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can find The World Shapers on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett and on Facebook at edward.willett. You can also find me on Instagram at Edward Willett Author. And of course, Shadowpaw Press, which will be publishing, again, Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, my second Kickstarted anthology featuring authors who were guests of this podcast, will be coming out very soon. And shadowpawpress.com is where you can find Shadowpaw Press. I think that about covers it for this week. So once again, thanks to David List for being my guest. Thanks to all of you for listening. I do have one bit of housekeeping to do, which is to remind you that this podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network.
The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Kinexus. Savings, checkings, GIC, budget, RESP, RRSP, TFSA, mutual funds, credit score, emergency funds, variable versus fixed rates, compound interest, retirement. The list goes on and on. It's time to make sense of it all. At Kinexus Credit Union, they want to help. Financial literacy is a critical life skill, giving you the knowledge and confidence to make smart, responsible decisions about your money. Visit kinexusmoneytalk.ca to find expert advice, tips, and solutions for all life stages and events, and increase your financial literacy knowledge and confidence today.
And that's that. So thank you again for listening to this episode of The World Shapers, and please come back many times in the future as I continue to interview the authors who have created the worlds and characters and adventures that we have enjoyed so much over the years, and find out just how they go about doing that, because this is a podcast all about the creative process. That's it for this episode. Bye for now.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.